Some of the biggest misconceptions about labor surround consent and your right for refusal. So today, we're going to talk about those myths and how knowledge can change your mindset in labor. Let's go. Hey friends, my name is Emily, and I'm your birth advocate. I'm a labor and delivery nurse that has a passion for helping birthers advocate for themselves against the toxic cultures of labor. I teach you the most up-to-date research surrounding pregnancy and birth, give you tips and tricks I have learned in my profession, and empower you to take back your rights as a birther. So welcome. Keep listening for authentic tips and evidence-based information you can count on. This is your Birth Advocate, the podcast. You guys, welcome to the podcast. I am so excited. This has been in the works for a really long time, and I'm so antsy for you guys to hear the podcast and to get your feedback and to see if you guys like it. I decided to start this podcast on a whim, like I do most things. I was just sitting around and I was thinking, maybe I should start a podcast. And then I just bought the equipment and struggled through the technology of recording and editing audio. But we have figured it out and hopefully we will get better. But I just thought, what better way of getting information out there than in a free long form version versus like Instagram or TikTok, where I get 30 to 60 seconds to talk about really important topics that really deserve way more time than that. So here we are on Your Birth Advocate, the podcast, and I am so excited. These first four episodes are gonna be my four tips to help you advocate for yourself in labor. Today, we're talking about how knowledge is power. Truly, there are some big myths out there that I'm hoping to bust for you to give you the knowledge you need and the confidence you need to advocate for yourself in labor. My hope is that after this podcast, your mindset on how much control you have of your body and labor will truly change, and it will help you advocate for yourself to the fullest extent. So first, let's talk about consent. Consent is when, in the just most basic forms, somebody tells you what they're going to do or what they would like to do, and you say yes. That is giving your consent. In the medical field, we call it informed consent because as medical professionals, we're required to tell you the risks and the benefits of what we're going to do so that you have the full version of what you're saying yes to. There are a couple different types of consent. One is written and one is verbal. Now, in the medical field, especially when you're having a baby, when you get admitted to the hospital, you will likely sign a consent that states that you will let them deliver for your baby. Usually it has a consent for repair of any lacerations, for use of vacuum or forceps, for episiotomy. These are considered some of the most standard procedures that we do on labor and delivery, some of which are used in emergency situations. So having that written informed consent prior is helpful so that we know what you're comfortable with and what you're not comfortable with. Also, you probably will sign a consent for a blood transfusion, again, in case of an emergency. The thing about written consent that a lot of people don't understand is that you can definitely revoke your written consent at any time. So if you come to the hospital and they give you the big long consent spiel and you say, yeah, you can deliver my baby, and of course you can do vacuum, forceps, or episiotomy in case of an emergency, like I want my baby to be saved. And of course you can repair lacerations because I don't want them to just go unrepaired and heal wrong. But then you're pushing, and in the moment your provider tries to use a vacuum or forceps and you don't feel like the intervention is necessary, and in that moment they don't give you informed consent, then you can revoke your consent. You can say, hold on, I don't consent to this. I need more information. And they can re-go over the informed consent process for that specific circumstance. This is why I want to do a vacuum. This is the risk for a vacuum in this situation. These are the benefits for the vacuum in this situation. And then you can decide verbally if you'd still like to proceed with consent. It's just like any other form of consent in which it can be revoked at any time. This is basic human knowledge that everybody should be holding in their daily life and certainly in the medical field. If you see somebody at a party and they say, yeah, let's go have sex later, and then later they say, no, just because they give you a yes earlier in the day doesn't mean that yes holds true later in the day. This is simple stuff that still holds true in the medical field, but sometimes it's not always presented like that, and I don't think that birthers always know that they have these choices. Let's talk about another version of consent that truly is not appropriate. And this just is a difference between assuming consent and obtaining explicit consent for interventions. I'm going to give you an example, and then we're going to talk about how this can change. We're going to start out with this example of assumed consent. So let's say that you are in labor, your provider comes in and says, "We're going to check your cervix now." Before you know it, she's got a glove on, she's going to check your cervix. You notice the nurse is in the corner of the room, kind of getting some equipment ready. You're not really sure what she's doing. While the provider still has her hand in your vagina, she says, "We're going to break your water now." The nurse quickly hands her something and boom, your water's broke. And you just kind of go with the flow because, you know, that's how labor goes. She's the expert. She knows what to do. And now your water's broke. Labor proceeds. What that provider is actually doing is not obtaining explicit informed consent for interventions. By just telling you what's going to happen and not giving you the space to first ask permission, but second, give you the risks and benefits, they are taking away your power and your control and your autonomy on your body. And it's honestly, it's not okay. And it happens all the time. I see it every day. Every day, even the best providers are not asking for consent for something as simple as a cervical exam or breaking your water, and I'm having to interject and ask for at least a quick consent. It's not enough, but at least it's asking the question before they do the intervention. And like I said, these are not bad providers. It's just the culture of labor and delivery and how our consent has been taken away from us. And it's something that by you being informed and expecting better, my hope is that it will slowly and gradually change for everyone. Now, let's say that now that you know this information, and you go into labor and delivery and you ask for explicit informed consent before any intervention. Let's see how that this circumstance can change for you. So instead, the provider comes in your room and asks you, "Can I check your cervix? Is now a good time?" And you ask her, "Well, why do you want to check my cervix? What is that going to change about my care?" So she proceeds to tell you that she'd like to check on your progress. It's been 4 hours since your last vaginal exam and your contractions have spaced out. So she wants to be sure that you're still progressing. And so you say, "Okay, that sounds fine. Go ahead." So she checks your cervix and then she says, "You haven't made any change. Do you mind if I break your water?" You stop her, ask her to stop the exam, and give you the risks, benefits, and alternatives to breaking your water. So she takes her hand out and she proceeds to tell you that breaking your water, the benefit would be that it could speed up labor for you without needing additional medication. The risks are prolapsed cord, accidental placental abruption, and a risk for infection if labor takes too long. She explains to you that she doesn't think these things are going to be a problem for you because your baby is very low, she knows the location of your placenta, and you're already 6 centimeters. So then you say, "Okay, well, can you give me 5 minutes? She walks out of the room, you discuss it with your support person, and then you ultimately decide that you'd like to wait a little bit longer. That is an example of how a situation should happen and how you obtained autonomy and control in your body in the circumstance. It looks completely different from the first scenario in which the provider had all the control and made all the decisions for you. In that second scenario, you made all the decisions for yourself. You took 5 minutes, which, by the way, is one of my biggest tips when making decisions in labor and advocating for yourself, is ask the providers to leave the room. It is so hard to make a decision and not feel pressured when the people are standing right in front of you. You need 5 minutes. You need to check in with yourself, check in with your support person who should be keeping you grounded, and try to make a decision that's best for you and your baby. So we've went over the myths surrounding consent, the difference between just plain consent and informed consent, the difference between explicit consent and assumed consent, the difference between written consent and verbal consent, and how all of that can impact your mindset in labor and your ability to advocate for yourself. Now, let's move on to another hot topic, another big misconception in labor, and that is your right to refuse interventions. This is actually one of my favorite things to talk about with people because it's kind of taboo, first of all. People do not like to talk about it, especially people in the healthcare field, because they feel like telling someone that they can refuse gives them some sort of liability if they do refuse, which is not true. Every time you go to the hospital, you sign your patient rights, whether you realize you did it or not, and in there is your right to refuse care. It's a basic healthcare right. It's a basic human right for everyone, and it goes hand in hand with consent. So it's definitely another thing that I love to talk about with my patients. I bring it up to almost every patient when they're trying to decide what to do when, honestly, it's a part of my admission speech that I give my patients, that we are here to facilitate their labor in a safe way, that we will give recommendations for care, but it is within their rights to refuse anything. So let's first talk about a big myth that you can't refuse care, especially when you're pregnant and you're in labor and you have another human that you're making decisions for, being the baby that you're growing. A lot of people assume that you are not allowed to refuse interventions because you could be putting the baby at risk, and that they have grounds for some kind of legal action, which obviously depends state by state. But basic fact is that any patient can refuse any intervention. Let me say that again. Any patient can refuse any intervention. And I'm not joking. I'm not making light of it. You can refuse any intervention. I don't recommend refusing every intervention. I recommend informed refusal. So just like informed consent, informed refusal is when you know the risks that you are taking on when you refuse an intervention. So, not only is it within your patient right to refuse interventions, actually, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, which is the OBGYN organization that puts out all of their practice statements and their opinions that most OBGYNs follow and cite in decision making, supports a pregnant birther's right to refuse interventions. And I am going to read off a statement directly from their website. Pregnancy is not an exception to the principle that a decisionally capable patient has the right to refuse treatment, even treatment needed to maintain life. Therefore, a decisionally capable pregnant woman's decision to refuse recommended medical or surgical intervention should be respected. That's right. Not only is it okay for you to refuse an intervention, it also should be respected. So if you're having trouble getting support from your nursing staff, from your doctor, provider staff, when you choose to refuse an intervention, I want you to pull up this direct statement on their website, and I'm going to have it linked in the description of this episode, and I want you to show it to them word for word and ask them why they are not following their organization's recommendation to support your right to refuse. And we'll see how they react to that. Because most times when providers are confronted with something explicitly, it's a lot harder for them to defend their actions, to be honest. And not only should it be respected, your right to refuse, there also are some unethical things that providers will do when you try to refuse that ACOG also does not support. And one of the main things is the use of coercion. So what the use of coercion when a patient refuses intervention sounds like is, let's say you say, "I refuse to push on my back," and your doctor says, "That's fine, but I'm not going to deliver you unless you're on your back." That's coercion. That's a fear tactic. That's them trying to scare you out of using your right to refuse. Or let's say, and I actually had this circumstance described to me by one of my followers. Let's say that your elective induction's not going well and you'd like to go home. There's not really any risk for you going home. Your water's not broke. Your cervix hasn't changed. Your baby looks fine. And you say, "I think I'm just gonna go home. This isn't working. I wanna wait for my body to be ready." And a provider actually told one of my followers, "That's fine, but you can find another doctor." Like, that is even okay in any sense. And let me just give you a little bit of advice. A doctor cannot legally or ethically refuse to take care of you if you present to the hospital. So ACOG has another statement on this specific coercion when it comes to refusing, and I'm going to read that off of their website too. "The use of coercion is not only ethically impermissible, but also medically inadvisable, because of the realities of prognostic uncertainty and the limitations of medical knowledge. As such, it is never acceptable for an obstetrician gynecologist to attempt to influence patient toward a clinical decision using coercion. Obstetrician gynecologists are discouraged in the strongest possible terms from the use of duress, manipulation, coercion, physical force, or threats, including threats to involve the courts or child protective services to motivate women towards a specific clinical decision. That's another thing that I've actually heard people say is that if they didn't consent to a C-section, they were going to call CPS. And actually, I've heard some people say that the CPS was involved in their decision to refuse. And as you can see on the website, that is not supported by ACOG. And again, I encourage you to pull this up, to report providers to their ethics board if they're using these kind of tactics. Now, you know you can refuse interventions, so you're ready to do that. But another thing that I hear a lot is that I couldn't do that because it was hospital policy. And I'm here to tell you a little secret. Hospital policy is not created for you, the patient, to follow. The purpose of a hospital policy is to give the healthcare providers, the nurses, the staff, a guide to follow. It is for nurses and staff to follow, not for patients to follow. So while a nurse cannot go against hospital policy herself, you as a patient are not obligated to follow hospital policy. So let's say there's a hospital policy that after your water's broke, you can't be out of bed at all, not even to go to the bathroom. And yes, this was a policy at a facility that I worked at. I'm not even gonna get into that topic today, but this was a policy. And so the nurse says, I'm sorry, it's against our policy to let you out of bed. Even to go to the bathroom, you need to use the bedpan. You as a patient can say, I refuse that policy. And that's the end of it. The nurse then will document that you refuse the policy. And now she is absolved of her responsibility of the policy, even the policies that she doesn't agree with. And you as a patient obtain your autonomy. So if a provider ever says to you, it's against our policy, you can just inform them that the policies are there for them to follow and you're still exercising your right to refuse. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about policies that are for like patient and staff safety. You can't refuse the policy to not have a weapon at the hospital. I'm talking specifically about patient care policies. Policies about eating and ambulating, about IV access. Those kind of policies are for healthcare providers and nurses, guidelines for their care, and they are bound to them, but you as a patient are not bound to them. So there you go. That's it. Those are my biggest myth-busting misconceptions about labor and delivery in the hospital when it comes to consent and refusing. And I really wanted to make this my very first podcast episode because I really think it's the foundation to advocating for yourself. Knowing your rights around consent and refusal is so important when you're trying to advocate for yourself in the hospital, because if you don't think that you can say no, then you're not going to. And if your options are not presented to you, then you have no options. So it's just so important that you know that you have the right to informed consent, you have the right to explicit consent, you have the right to change your mind, and you definitely have the right to refuse things. So I really hope this was helpful for you today. Every episode, I'd like to take a question that I got from TikTok or Instagram and answer it right here on the podcast. So this is a question from Sierra Likes Dogs, love your username, on TikTok. She says, do RNs slash doctors turn off epidural when patient pushes? My epidural worked up until delivery and I don't know why. So kind of two questions, right? First question, do RNs or doctors turn off your epidural when you're pushing? I'd like to say no, but I do know of some instances where nurses or the doctor slash midwife would turn off the epidural. Usually it's because the patient is not feeling anything and either they don't think pushing will be effective or they've tried pushing and it's not effective. Now, ethically, I don't think that this is appropriate without the patient's knowledge. I have turned off an epidural, well, I have turned down or off an epidural twice while pushing, and it was only with the patient patients explicit consent. I asked them, I explained to them the situation that I think that the baby wasn't really moving down because her epidural was so dense and that she just really didn't know where to push. And she had already expressed that to me while we were pushing both of these birthers. And I said, one thing that we could try is turning down your epidural or turning off your epidural. Both birthers gave me consent and I only did it with their consent. But I do know some providers and nurses who do it without telling the birther, and that honestly I think is not okay. But I do know that it happens. So the second part of her question has to do with her epidural working well until delivery. And I have three thoughts about this. The first one obviously is that someone could have turned down or off her epidural without telling her. The second one is that sometimes what people don't realize is that even though your epidural is working, your body is still experiencing more and more pain. Now, it's not often that the epidural's effectiveness is decreasing. It's just that when we give you an epidural, we set it at a continuous rate of medication at a certain dosage that covers the pain that you were in that moment. Now, as you progress through labor, your body naturally experiences more pain. You're not feeling that gradual increase of pain because of your epidural, but at some point, the epidural medication threshold may have been met, and that medication dose that they originally started you on is not enough for the pain that you're experiencing closer to delivery. So it's often not the epidural not working, it's your body's pain ramping up, because as you get closer to delivery, you are in more pain and in different types of pain. So a lot of times, all you really need is some extra medication from your anesthesiologist or anesthetist. A lot of times, all you need is some extra medication or an increase in the continuous dose that you receive. Now, another thing that happens sometimes is that as we are flipping and flopping and turning you like we should be, and as you're pushing, the epidural catheter that's placed in your back could be creeping out. So slowly backing out and not in the position that it was originally placed. When this happens, a lot of time it's not that the epidural just stops working altogether, but it just becomes less effective because the medication is not getting exactly in the spot that it was supposed to get. So the spot that takes away your pain is getting less medication than originally intended, which it can happen because of all the different positions, especially if we're having to move you a lot because of baby's heart rate or to try to get you comfortable. It can happen. Not that you should be fearful of moving, because that's part of what makes labor progress, but it's definitely important to listen to your nurses and your staff on the right way to move. So I hope that answers your question. Every week, I really want to answer some questions for you guys. So if you ask me a question on Instagram or TikTok, just know that it could be at the end of any podcast episode. Okay. And next episode, which is actually available right now, is my second tip for advocating for yourself. And it's all about choosing your right provider and what to do when you can't choose your right provider. So check it out. Please, please, please subscribe to the podcast. Give me feedback. Leave reviews, because all of this is so helpful for me to know what you guys want, because the whole reason I do this is for you. And also check out my TikTok and my Instagram at Your Birth Advocate and interact with me. Send me messages. I love to hear that kind of stuff. Thanks, guys.